Okay, good morning. I'd like to invite everyone to come in and take a seat. You are welcome to sit in seats up in this area. So, good morning. On behalf of Open Source, a halacha think tank, I want to welcome you to today's Yom Iyun. My name is Ethan Tucker. I'm the director of Open Source, and I'm really delighted to see all of you here at the West End Synagogue, the home of Yeshivat Hadar. First, a few just logistical announcements before we get into the substance of the day. You should have the day's program in front of you, have gotten one at the registration desk downstairs. I think the schedule is fairly self-explanatory. If you have not already downstairs indicated the sessions that you intend to attend, please do so at the registration desk downstairs after the opening plenary. There'll be a short break between the opening plenary and the first session. That will enable us to assure that we have the correct number of copies. You should expect, in terms of format other than the opening plenary, to hear in each session a synthetic, thought-out presentation by the presenter, and then that to be followed by time for questions and discussion. And I will urge the presenters to allow at least 15 to 20 minutes or so at the end for such discussion while still ending on time. Also, those who ordered lunch in advance, it will be provided. Others who did not, you can avail yourself of the many establishments in the neighborhood, and we have information about that also available. And for those who only registered for the Yom Iyun as walk-ins today, volunteers are available to make sure that you are properly registered. And we just ask you to provide us with contact information so we can keep you abreast of upcoming activities here at Open Source. So, this think tank was founded in an effort to further a public conversation about halakha that many of us felt was not being had. A conversation that would combine historical sensitivity with religious commitment, and one that would understand that the truest reverence for halakha is one that seeks to understand the underlying values that inform the discipline that Jewish law and practice demands. This Yom Iyun, I'm proud to say, is really a landmark day for that enterprise, in that it is bringing this conversation into its most open and public forum to date. Today I would suggest to you is a Yom HaTava LeRabbanan, a great day for the Rabbanan, in two senses. One is in the sense that my hope and expectation is that it will be a very good day for those of us who are rabbis, fans of rabbinic literature, etc. That much interesting Torah will be taught here today in this building, and that the conversation about halakha that we're engaging today promises to be fruitful and enriching. But it is also a Yom HaTava LeRabbanan, a great day for our sages of blessed memory, for Chazal, and I want to say a few words about why I think that's the case. We're here today because there has been a stirring in recent years, still small but significant, among those of us who believe that halakha should mean something, should be about something. We seek a halakha that is not just worthy of obedience, but that is worthy of respect. A halakha that does not ask for submission despite ourselves, but rather one that invites us to take up the mantle of responsibility to speak the language of Chazal in the contemporary world. Contrary to those who see the acid test of halachic commitment as irrational or at least non-rational fealty to an inscrutable divine will, the presenters you will hear today share a conviction that we are engaged in the same enterprise that has animated halachic discourse for millennia. The effort, undertaken often with great humility and trepidation, to understand how God's word and a vision of goodness ought to be played out in our contemporary world. The presenters are a group of budding scholars and teachers who, for all their grappling with Chazal's legacy, strive to identify with the values that underlie our sages' teachings, to own those values and to apply them to our lives. And so it is a Yom HaTava LeRabbanan, a good day for our sages, when so many people gather to understand their words, to drink deeply from their wisdom, and to seek their good counsel in chartering a religious path forward. You will not hear anything today about tradition and change, a slogan that presumes alienation from a static conversation as all remaining energy is poured into testing the limits of the possibility of escaping it. You will hear little about questions of Chazal's authority over us. Their authority is presumed and embraced, as is the dynamism of their teaching and the multiplicity of its applications. This, in short, is an inside conversation, one that wears rabbinic sources with comfort and genuinely seeks to hear what those sources say and how those who listen to them today react and respond. There are many wonderful folks gathered here today. One person is sorely missing. Rav Elisha Anshelovitz, a Yadin Yadin graduate of Yeshiva University, a teacher of Torah at, among other places, Yeshivat Ma'alei Gilboa and Pardes, has been a teacher and mentor in one way or another to all those presenting today and to many here in the Kahal. He has been a visionary and pioneer in articulating this direction for contemporary halachic discourse and in imagining what a revived halachic conversation can and ought to look like in the broader Jewish community. Rav Elisha has graciously submitted a paper that is already available on some of the tables downstairs. We'll make a few extra copies at lunchtime. But I want to quote 2 points from it briefly by way of inviting all of you into the proper posture to get the most out of this day. The first point goes to one of the basic elements of looking at halacha as a discourse of values. The ability to see beyond the details and local application of a text in order to arrive at an underlying motivating concern. The search for values in halacha presumes that the details are dots that must be connected in order to arrive at the larger picture that communicates a larger truth. Rav Elisha quotes from Moshe Mordechai Epstein, the Rosh Yeshiva of Slobodka in the late 19th and early 20th century, to this effect. Ikar yediyat ha-Torah lo bekiyut v'tzurat ha-dvarim, ach ikar ha-yediyah hi svarat v'havanat ha-dvarim. Im echad baki b'halacha achat ve'eino yodea svarat v'hergesh ha-dvarim, lo nuchal lomar ki chaser lo miktzat ha-davar, ach kol ha-davar chaser lo. Ki ikar ha-davar hu svarat ha-davar. Ve'al yedei ze, al yedei ha-svara, in his translation, vast superficial knowledge of information is not considered knowledge of Torah. Rather, real knowledge involves understanding the underlying reasons. Thus, if one knows all the details of a given halakha but does not understand and feel its reason, he is not merely missing part of the matter, but rather the whole matter. For a halachic topic is primarily its reason, since on the basis of its reason, the practical halachic implementation can change from one extreme to another. So I invite you to follow our presenters today on this quest for reason and meaning, and to understand that the journey comes not from a desire to outsmart the law, but precisely from a motivation to understand it so that it can be properly applied. The second point relates to the sort of disposition required for true learning. And here Rav Elisha invites the serious student of halacha to, quote, liberate one's own and the other's insights from one's own and the other's positions regarding the good life. In other words, drop your preconceptions and your political fears regarding what ground must be defended and attacked at all costs. In the words of Rabbi Yochanan, also quoted in the paper, Ein divrei Torah mitkaimim ela b'misha mesim atzmo kemisha eino. Only when we cease being dogmatically full of ourselves and our assumptions can we truly be open to the internalization of the wisdom of Torah. So I invite you today to open yourselves to that conversation and to consider angles of learning that may take you to new places. It's now my privilege to introduce to you my friend, colleague, teacher, and one-time chavruta, Professor Chaim Seyman. Chaim's bio is printed for you in all its glory on the program you received on the way in, and I won't rehearse those details here. Chaim is someone who suffers neither fools nor mediocrity, and thus being able to call yourself his friend is a great compliment. He has thought very deeply about halacha as a discipline and the ways in which various frames on Jewish law can shape and at times distort its content and presentation. He brings the perspective of both a Talmid Chacham and an accomplished legal thinker to his analysis. His remarks this morning will place today's project of thinking about halacha as a discourse of values in a broader perspective. And I can think of no better person to kick off our conversation this morning. So please welcome Professor Chaim Seyman.
I some point I'm going to get him back for all that, but I'll figure out exactly how. Talking after Rav Eitan is scary for a variety of reasons. But I just, you know, liftach b'chavod achsanya. It's been about 10, 12 years since Eitan and I were chavrutas. And we argued then. I think we still argue about a lot of things. But he has really taught me, and by extension my wife and family, so much about commitment to halacha and providing a way of thinking about that. And I'm deeply appreciative. When we learned all those years ago, Eitan talked about this machon, this yeshiva, as if it existed at the time. And I'm like, dude, this guy's like just whacked. And he just like spoke me, no, it's here. It's like Ba'ain. And it's truly satisfying for me to come and to see that this thing, you know, that was in his mind and I thought it was just nuts, actually exists and has accomplished so much to date, and I think is only at the beginning. So I take a lot of pride and really joy in being here and watching something that a good friend had sort of thought about for so long, so intensely, come into fruition. Now, what I want to talk about today is to sort of frame the conversation as I see it, which, you know, and to use the sugya of halanat schar sachir, withholding a worker's wages, which is primarily in Bava Metzia, as a sort of vehicle to get us to think about different frames and different ways to think about halacha and halachic discourse. Now, I think we'll start by saying, does halacha speak the language of ethics and morality? When I ask this question, and whether I speak at a, you know, more Haredi yeshiva or at a university or wherever it is, it's funny. The one thing I always get is the answer is, of course, to this question. Of course halacha is about ethics. Of course halacha is about morality. That's probably the only similarity I get, but I always get that. And then I say, well, really? I said, what is the Hebrew word for ethics? The rabbinic word? And we always get the silence. He says, what about morality? What about virtue? I said, like, if I knew a little Greek, I could tell you the Greek words for these things. I know they exist. There are no rabbinic words for these. Let's talk about other important words, important for us, that don't seem to exist in the classic rabbinic canon. Politics, philosophy, democracy, theocracy, even theology, autonomy, universalism, particularism, culture, sexuality, theory. Basically, the canon does not have any of these abstract, conceptual, maybe philosophic terms that we use and need to structure our reality. On the other hand, let me throw out some terms that any halachist is familiar with. Kimle b'derabimine, chaticha naset nevela, sveik sveika, breira, dabar sheish lo matirin, kinyan dvarim. Try to translate these is like ridiculously impossible. These are mid-level, these are conceptual, they're abstract, but they're insanely legal. Most of us, certainly when we step outside the Dalet Amot Shel Halacha, could probably live our lives just fine having never encountered any of these terms. And yet, this is the way Halacha is put together. These terms form the backbone of its structure. So we ask something very difficult. We have ourselves in halacha. We say, hey, we live here today under our conditions. All these terms, the philosophical terms or the Western canonical terms, are really important to us. That's how we think of reality. We also think halacha tells us who we are, where we're going, what we're supposed to do, but it doesn't talk our language. The language we want it to talk, it doesn't. The language it talks, we don't really understand. That's a tall order, and I think that's what I call the question. To me, the question which I've probably, you know, been asking in one level or another for many, many years. How does this work? Why is it that our tradition is so good at the small legal particular? And as soon as you ask it to sort of move away from that, it sort of loses its bearing. How do we understand this sort of insatiable, I mean, I'm a law professor, so I love this stuff, insatiable appetite for legal details. Now, whether I became a law professor because I was in yeshiva or the other way around, I don't know. But some people are not plagued by this disease. How do you understand it? Why is it that the Gemara can go on and on and on, sort of like keep on pounding away at all these little things, and then as soon as you step back, you seem to be in a vacuum? I call that the question of halakha. And I think the first people to sort of ask this, or to try to address this, is what I'm going to call the Tamei HaMitzvot crowd. I'm thinking here of like the Rambam, the Sefer HaChinuch, maybe some of the Gaonim, the rationalistically minded Gaonim and Rishonim, who thought to marry some sort of Greek philosophical ethics, usually based on Aristotle, with the mitzvot. Now, they were preceded to some degree. I mean, Philo, who lived before Chazal, did something like this, but of course, without not taking Chazal into account. But it's really, and, you know, we might think of the Rambam as being the sort of core character in this narrative, are the first to try to make this move. And basically, overgeneralizing a tremendous amount, what he said was, it's true that the Greeks thought about this in a kind of more structural and philosophic manner, but really, that's what the mitzvot are. They're teaching virtues and they're teaching ethics. And maybe the machloket between the Jewish and the Greek version is that the Jews always thought, achareya ma'asim nimshachim alevavot, in other words, practice, doing it, teaching you the virtue, whereas the Greeks maybe thought sort of speculation was it. But that's really what the mitzvot are about. Now, this is probably the version of Tamei HaMitzvot that we all learned in one form or another in school. The Sefer HaChinuch is a very common entry point into this, and he typically quotes the psukim and then kind of says, you know, Tamei HaMitzvot, Misharshe HaMitzvot, and kind of gives what I would call a standard Tamei HaMitzvot read to a lot of it. Now, I think this is all good, but I've always felt that there's a big problem. Is that the stuff only seems to work if you don't really know the Gemara. So it sort of like says, all right, if you know Tanakh and maybe a few Mishnahs, it's sort of satisfying. But as soon as you spend any time getting, you know, Rosho Verubo Letocha Sugya, right, getting your head and really into the analytics of the Gemara, they're like talking a different language. It doesn't fit. It doesn't answer all the nuance. It doesn't explain why we're so interested in these categories and these details. Right? It sort of hovers over kind of nicely over the kind of Tanakhic ambiance of the mitzvah, but as soon as we get inside, it sort of either doesn't address it or actually says things that are in some deep tension with the halachic details as worked out in the halacha itself. So I thought to, rather than talk abstractly, let's kind of look at this, and I hope everyone has his handout. Let's look for a second at the psukim. Again, this is the issue of halanat schar sachir, probably translated as withholding a worker's wages. There are two psukim, one in Vayikra and one in Dvarim, three actually. And in Vayikra we say, lo ta'ashok et reyecha, velo tigzol, velo talin, pulat sachir, itcha ad boker. Which, in the translation that I found off the internet, which I believe is some more proper one, says, you shall not oppress your neighbor or rob him. The wages of the hired servant shall not remain with you all night until morning. In Dvarim, it's a little more complicated, a little more interesting. Lo ta'asok schar ani ve'avion me'achicha, o migercha asher ba'artzecha bisharecha, rather be'omot titen scharo, ve'lo tavo alav ha'shemesh ki anihu, ve'ilav hu noset nafsho, ve'lo yikra elecha el Hashem, v'ayab ha'chet. You shall not oppress a hired servant who is poor and needy, whether he is one of your brothers or one of the sojourners who are in your land or in your towns. Rather, you should give him his hire on the day he earns it, before the sun goes down, for he is poor and he sets his heart upon it, lest he cry against you to the Lord and it be a sin in you. So if we were to do the standard Tamei HaMitzvot sort of approach, what we would say is, look, this is about workers' rights, workers' ethics, how to treat people honestly and fairly in business, particularly the day laborer or someone sort of in the lower social class, and you should take care of them. And basically, you know, oversimplifying a little bit, that's what you get in the standard Tamei HaMitzvot accounts. The problem is that as one learns through the Sugya and Bava Metzia, we get a whole bunch of details that are either not explained by this account or run pretty, you know, create some serious tensions with it. Now, I listed for you on the bottom there just some bullet points of the stuff discussed in the Gemara. One is that the prohibition only applies if the Baal HaBayit, if the hirer, has money. If he has the money in hand, that's when Halanat Sakhir applies. But suppose I hired a worker without having any money, I'm putter. I'm not, this halacha doesn't apply to me. Now, this seems kind of funny, right? We would think maybe the opposite. It's much worse to go and hire someone when you know at the time you have no chance of paying him, right, than whether you could but don't. Another example is that Isur only applies the first day, or it's really more technical, the first time period afterwards. Thereafter, day 2, day 3, day 4, day 5, the Isur doesn't apply. Again, we would think, well, maybe it should be the opposite, right? Withholding the wages might get increasingly worse. Now, we can maybe argue about can you fit it in or not. I think the important point is that the Tamei Mitzvah literature doesn't even try. These things are not accounted for. Let me go for another slightly more complex example. In the Mishnah, we talk about a poel, which is a day laborer. In other words, the way he's hired is he works for X amount of dollars per day. The Mishnah and the Gemara then turn to ask, what about a kablan? What about what we would call a contractor or a jobber? In other words, someone paid for the job. Is he part of the Isur or is he not? Now, I think if under any way of viewing this, we have to ask what the rule should be. Under the, quote, ethics approach, or the Tamei Mitzvot approach, we say, well, what's the purpose of this halakha? And are there morally salient differences between the guy paid by day versus the guy paid by job? I think that's the way you answer that question. What I want to show is that that's not at all the way the Gemara thinks about the question. The Gemara thinks about it like a lawyer would. It says, well, it depends on this technical Talmudic concept called whether Uman kone b'shvach kli, which basically translated means, what is the transactional structure of what happens when I hire someone to do a job for me? In other words, pay by the job. So the Gemara says like this. So suppose the case is typically, I hire someone to build a chair for me. So is that, did I hire him to build a chair? In other words, almost paying him per hour? Or is really what happened is, I contracted with him for him to sell me a chair. So the Gemara says like this. If you think Uman kone b'shvach kli, as he's building the chair, he, the carpenter, acquires rights in that by virtue of his labor, then what's really happening is he's going to sell it to me at the end. If he's selling to me, our transaction is one of mekachumem kar, of a sale, rather than schirut, rather a hire. However, if you hold ein uman kone b'shvach kli, that the way you conceptualize this transaction is that I'm basically just hiring him for the job, then he would be subject to the isur. Right? Our relationship is such structure. Now, for the lawyer, this has a lot of appeal. There's a category, we need to define it. How are we going to define it? Based on its legal properties. Now, I just don't see how this way of thinking about the problem at all tracks any sort of ethical conception that the Tamei Mitzvot people would talk about. I mean, how the law chooses to conceptualize a certain transaction, which might be based on how we choose to verbalize it, does not seem morally salient to the power structure between the hirer and the hired in such a way that which impact should impact whether the issue applies to this person or not. Now I want to go a step further. And the step further is the Gemara says, suppose I'm the Baal Bayit, if I hire the worker through a shaliach, through an agent, the Gemara says that neither me nor the agent are subject to the Isur. So if I ask Rabbi Tan to hire the worker, and he hires the worker, so I'm out and he's out. I'm out because I didn't hire him. In other words, I'm not subject to the Isur. And he's not subject to the Isur because he's not withholding the wages. The wages are being withheld with me. Such that if we think of it in a very categoric term, any lawyer knows that just give me the rules and I'll tell you how to get around them. That's what we do. And that's, now even more amazingly, rather than the Gemara kind of bent, saying, hey, Gevalt, you can get around this, you know what? Mereimer Mar Zutra, that's what they did. Mereimer Mar Zutra seemingly routinely would hire workers for each other so that they would not be subject to the Isur. Now I come back to our friends at Tamei Mitzvot and say, like, help me, like, what are you going to say here? And interestingly, they don't say a whole lot. It's like they sort of, like, don't think that this is part of the data set they need to explain. The Rambam has this version that he's just explaining Tanakh. And I'm like, okay, that'd be nice if we lived Tanakh. But we live halacha as understood through the Mishnah, Gemara, and the Poskim, and that's what needs explained. Now, I think because of some the understandings, or maybe because, or another way to look at this sort of starts from the opposite conception. I'm going to call this the Brisker approach, but I'm going to use the term very loosely. I'm going to also talk about things that are technically of the Brisker approach, but something that represents maybe sort of Eastern European approaches to the yeshivas in the past 200 years, and I'm going to stereotype here, because it's much easier than actually going through all sorts of variations. Now, if the Tamei HaMitzvot people started with the assumption that it's ethics, and then kind of ran into problem when we started pointing out the law, the Briskers start from the other way. It's law, buddy. And their issue is, but what happens beyond these categories? Now, a basic take is something like, the field of halakha is structured by legal rules and legal principles. In its most radical form, those legal rules, categories, and principles are hardwired into the structure of creation itself. They understand the famous Ma'amar Chazal, Yistakel Be'oraita Uvara Alma, God looked into the Torah and created the world, and then God looked into the legal categories that make up Tarsh Baal Peh, and the world reflects them. Therefore, as reported, but it's reported from Rav Chaim Soloveitchik, who said that murder is not bad because it's bad, and tzedakah is not good because it's good. Rather, murder is bad because that's the way God structured the category. And tzedakah is good because that's the way God structured the category. Haipalemi Hashem Devar. Could God not have structured the world the other way? Now, this is, of course, the most extreme version of the Brisker approach, which basically says that our intuitions are not what's relevant or important. It's all about the categories. If the categories match our intuitions, wonderful. If not, so what? That was never the question. So, for example, to kind of ratchet it back a notch, if I'm trying to sell my house to somebody, the way I do that is through this formal, predetermined mechanism of a kinyan, a mode of acquisition. If I successfully manipulate the levers of kinyan to effectuate the sale goes through. If I don't, no matter how much I want to sell, and no matter how much the buyer wants to buy, I just haven't gone through the right channels. And the kind of social angst about, yeah, but they really wanted to, just doesn't matter. So just like we could say, I can have all the Kabbalistic kavanos in the world, and if I eat matzah on the 14th of Nisan, you know what we say? Doesn't matter. If I take a lulav with a lemon, and I've dipped in the mikvah 73 times, and I've said all that like stuff that they're now printing in the machzors, it doesn't matter. I just haven't done it right. And that's the way halacha works. We might think of it as taking a ritualistic conception of halacha, which certainly applies to some of it, and sort of spreading it throughout the entire realm, even, or maybe especially to those, which seem to have a much more obvious social component. Now, before we rag on the Briskers, I think that there's a lot here. It explains the Talmudic preoccupation with all the categories. If the categories and defining them precisely are really important, well, then a lot of Gemara now makes sense a lot better than it did under this Tamei HaMitzvot thing. I understand what they're doing. They're trying to fit together how the system works. A phrase taken from the common law tradition, but I think fits in nicely here, they used to say that the cases are evidence of the law. The Briskers view something similar. The halachos, and here's where I think there's going to be a lot of affinity between the Brisker approach and maybe the value approach, the halachos are evidence of some higher level commitment. But those higher level commitments in the Brisker world are fully legal analytical, and therefore the task is to articulate and clarify the category. Now, they have a lot of evidence, I think, from our sugya. For example, the Gemara doesn't ask the question we asked of, why is this only on the first day? Doesn't the problem get worse as we go on? The Gemara says you can contract, the Poel and the Baal Bayit can contract around it. Right? The Gemara doesn't ask, that's not just. The Gemara doesn't say, what are you doing with the Shliach? How can you do that? Aren't you evading the purpose? Right? The Gemara is silent to all this. I think the Brisker would say, with a great amount of credibility, that the Gemara is modeling how we should learn. It tries to define the categories and is not asking those questions. In parlance, sometimes they call it the what-why distinction. The goal of Talmud Torah is to ask what the Torah requires and how the categories are constructed, not why, not asking into their purpose. And to the extent they are problems, well, they're God's problems, and they're not our problems. Now, of course, by definition, calling a category formal means to emphasize its formal properties and to take away its substantive properties. That's the whole point of formalism in any field, is to say, rather than rethink the purpose all the time, we're going to use the form and let that guide us. Now, what are the drawbacks? I think there's one very interesting one that comes up in our sugya. Remember that we talked that the Gemara says that Maremar and Rabashi, I believe, would hire shlichim, right, would each appoint each other a shliach to hire their workers. The Tosafot say, they sort of ask our question. They say, how could they be trying to evade the halacha? And what Tosafot says is that, no, he was afraid that he would get caught up in something else and that the poa would come and demand his wage and he would be harried or harassed. He wouldn't do it. He would be over in the ether. And that's why they did it. Now, from there, it's just a small step to say, maybe that's what one should do. Maybe lechatchila, if I know I'm going to hire a worker, I don't know about the worker, but what I really don't want to do is be over the ether. So let me hire a shliach, and to tell a shliach to hire the worker. That way, I'm putter, he's putter, and then, I'll pay the worker on time, but if I don't, I haven't been over the ether. Now this sounds crazy, but this is what the Shach more or less says. He quotes the Sefer Chassidim, and the Shach on Shulchan Aruch more or less seems to say that, therefore, based on this, one should transact this way. Now, the Sefer Chassidim is certainly not a brisker, and the Shach is maybe some sort of proto-brisker, but I think you see sort of where this is coming from. If the categories are what's important, and we feel ourselves barred from pushing into the substance, this sort of structure makes a tremendous amount of sense. We'll be certain not to be over the Yisur, and the fact that the Poel may or may not get his money is, I think it's not fair to say it's not our concern, but it's not our primary concern. Now you see what's happened here is that the law, and law does this, it can kind of create its own universe, and if we go back to the Psukim, we've now turned the thing 180 degrees on its head. The Psukim tell us to be concerned with the status of the worker, and once you go through the halacha, we basically wind up being very concerned with the status of the halacha, and we a little bit forgot about the worker on the way. Now, the briskers claim, and this would be a more narrowly brisker claim, that the halacha is a closed system. It's logic, they used to say, it's not balabatish logic, which might be something like ordinary common sense logic, it's lumdish logic. It's the internal logic of the system. And therefore, that meant that the canons of evidence and what kind of an argument was sort of internal to the language of the sugyot itself. How does that matter here? So if we're learning our sugya of halachas shachar sachir, does it matter if, suppose, all the employers in the area say, we're only going to hire shachirim via shliach? Does that impact the way we think about this halacha? So if that's true, in a practical sense, and this is again what lawyers do, say, pay us money and we'll tell you how to get around the rules. Right? As a practical sense, no worker in this imagined economy is ever going to have the protections of the shaliach. Another halacha is that you can contract around it. In other words, if the worker says, I'm waiving, what we would call in law, waiving my rights to halanat shachar sachir, in most opinions in the poskim, that's fine. He can do that. So suppose there's a form contract. I've written these. There's a form contract that says anyone who wants to be a poel has to sign this form. Of course, there's far more poel in looking for work than balabatim having work, so every poel signs on the dotted line, which they would say clicks, I agree. Now, of course, he's just waived his right to halanat shachar sachir. Does that matter? The brisker model doesn't really have a place where this sort of information can come in, because it's interested in the categories. It's a Beit Midrash experience. it's not really thinking about what's going out there in the world. It's just not really its concern. It has textual questions and textual problems, and therefore looks for textual solutions. Part of the way the system is structured, whether by design or simply by outcome, is to sort of wall off what happens outside and to say, we're here inside the Beit Midrash, let us see how we can best understand it. We could go the other way. Suppose that we're very machmir on all the halanat schar sachir things, so that everybody says, you know what, it's not worth hiring Jews. They're too expensive. I'm going to hire only non-Jews. And now what you've done is you've created a system of very, very strong halanat schar sachir protections, except that no Jews are getting jobs because they're too expensive. In each case, what we're saying is the stuff that happens on the outside doesn't have a place to penetrate. Now, I think the Briskers have two types of responses for this. One is they say, look, that's true. But if you look at the tshuvot of the master halachicists, they always know how to kind of get this stuff in. It's true that they don't often overtly talk about it, and maybe they shouldn't. Sometimes I believe they shouldn't. But if you look, and maybe like a Rav Moshe Feinstein would be a great example of this, right? Rav Moshe sort of always eventually knows how to do the right thing, even though he doesn't talk about them quite this way. And now, I think that there's a lot of truth to that, except there's a little problem. It relies on a sort of maverick reading of a text, and it's somewhat episodic. It relies on the stature and the charisma of the posek. But what it does is it deprives us, the community of those kamid zalacha, of coming up with any way of systematically thinking about these questions. How should the question of sar sachir in an economy where there's far more workers than balabatim apply? If we're always going to rely on these sort of episodic maverick readings to kind of get the right answer, we lose the ability to figure out how to think about that. And I think that we need that. The only way we're going to understand how these categories are supposed to apply is by being able to talk about it, to test out different theories, and to test out assumptions. The other approach is what I call the Lifnim Mishurat Hadin approach. Now, Rav Lichtenstein tells this story, and I think it illustrates the point well. And this, the details might be a little off, but it's basically he was walking in Shari Chesed, you know, that when, maybe still today, but one of those places in Yerushalayim where you can still have the different worlds of Yerushalayim meet. And there's an Arab merchant on his way to the shuk, and he rounds the corner, and all his fruits and vegetables fall off his donkey cart. And there's two what seem to be Chiloni Jews walking by, and they immediately see and they help the guy load up his fruit. And there's two yeshiva guys there who are all enthralled in the question of whether Prika to Ina applies here. And they're going back and forth with tzoses and yeshivases, and are sort of watching this happen. And Rav Lichtenstein sort of always laments and says, why can't we have both? And what he would counsel and has is that of course you're supposed to help them. Whether the sugya applies, deal with that before, deal with that after, but don't sit there asking that question. I would say this is the Lifnim Mishurat Hadin approach. He says, yes, there's a law, but of course, sometimes it's supposed to go beyond the letter of the law. Usually the Ramban in Parshas Kedoshim is invoked in these sort of situations. Now, I think, again, it gets the right answer, but it sort of rips the rug out of what I thought were the best parts of the Brisker approach. The best parts of the Brisker approach is that they explained why we're always obsessed about these categories, why it's so important. But now, to sort of parrot Rav Lichtenstein, if in Morning Seder we're going to learn that the most important way to connect to HaKadosh Baruch Hu and our avoda is centered around precise definition of these categories, but then at the moment we would care most, i.e. when the rubber hits the road, we say, yeah, don't really worry about them, well then what are we doing? I think Hadra Kushtan Leduchte, right? We're back to where we started, which is, how do we understand this massive outpouring of legal analytics that we find in the Gemara? Now, I think for variations of sort of the perceived and felt shortcomings of these approaches, we are, as Rabbi Tan said, sort of slowly groping towards something that, I'm not sure I like this word, but we'll use it, the values approach, which is sort of built on the attractions of both the Tamei HaMitzvot and the classical Brisker approach, but is trying to sort of have fewer of its drawbacks. I think we start with the position that the categories and the halachot are about something, That's something we should be able to articulate, to recognize, and most of the time, tell whether it's working or not. Similarly, though, it really has to take account of the substance of rabbinic discourse, right? We've got to make sure that we have an explanation for all the stuff we see in the Gemara and the Rishonim and the Poskim. We can't just elide over that. Also, like the Briskers, it understands that the technical bits of law, and I think you saw this in the quote from Rav Moshe Mordechai Epstein, are evidence of some purpose that is sort of lurking behind and betwixt those details. I think the big difference between the values approach and the Brisker approach is what type of meta categories are you willing to use? Are they fully internal legal analytic, or are they possibly social, philosophical, or other sort of ism that we can come up with? Now, I'd like to close with a word of celebration and some words of caution. First, celebration. As I'm reminded often, I'm not a Jewish historian. Because I say things like, lawyers can say things that like don't have to be historically true. But I think, and someone will correct me if I'm wrong, here's what I'm sure of. Frustration with what we'll call rabbinic legalism or Talmudism is not new. There are 2nd, 1st, 2nd, 5th, 9th, 12th, 15th, 17th, 19th, and 20th, and now 21st century versions of this question. My sense is that in the past, when these questions have come up, the answer has been, let us refocus our attention away from the world of Chazal and the rabbis and towards something else. That something else is often Tanakh, Jewish philosophy, Jewish history, Jewish poetry, Jewish art, Jewish spirituality, any one of these things. And that's my sense, that in the past, when these questions have come up, those seeking to formulate responses have in one way or another, overtly or inadvertently, whatever the opposite of overtly is, quietly. Sorry, what?
Covertly,
there we go. I knew it'd come in eventually. So, overtly or covertly have said, you know, this Talmud stuff, push it aside. I think you see this in the curricular structure of the rabbinical, of you know, what we call the non-Orthodox rabbinical seminaries in the 19th and 20th century. Right? Lots more Bible, lots more theology, lots more philology, lots more Jewish history, lots more focus on Jewish culture. And when we do look at the rabbinic system, we look at it with a sort of historic detachment, a story of how we got to where we are, but not a system that we live. I think what's interesting is, for the first time in the past 15, 20 years, there's a movement that we ought to come with all these questions, but that the answer is not to go look in another books and to sort of restructure what the canon is about, as much as to start to reconceptualize what it is that the Talmud and the Mishnah and the Talmud and its descendants are about. Now, to that end, I sort of, on the back of this page, I won't go through them in great detail, sort of listed what I think are the emerging themes of this values approach. And these are just my thoughts, so they'll probably be proven false through the course of the day. But I think the first thing, and I'll just highlight them quickly, is a literary sensitivity particular to the structure of the Sugya and the Talmud, attempt to reintegrate halacha and agadah, and to say that sometimes even, quote, halachic sugyas can be telling us an agadic message, which is more about a framework and a perspective for solving difficult personal and societal problems than a series of rules that are sort of mandated in this rigid form. I think the second thing is to say to repeat what we said before, that halachic categories are substantive, that their interpretation has and should be performed with an awareness that law accomplishes and does things in society, and that we ought to pay attention to that. That the legal debates in the Talmud and the post-Talmudic literature are different attempts by Chazal and the Chachamim to weigh the pros and cons of different ways of constructing a mitzvah and conceptualizing it. Moreover, that the discourse of Chazal invites us to participate in the ongoing dialogue of figuring out how to concretize Hashem's mitzvah in our lives. To borrow a phrase from a legal philosopher, we might say that halacha is authoritative rather than authoritarian. The thing, I think, is that you can't discuss law solely from the analytic textual perspective. You have to understand that law does stuff in the world, and we ought to pay attention to what's going on in the world as we structure and restructure the legal categories. Four, I think, is a greater awareness that when we talk about the halacha, it's actually a bunch of different strands of a tradition that are sort of constantly in dialogue with each other, and that we can't find an answer that fits everything. It won't. What we look is for what people now call the best reading, the sort of most appropriate way to stitch these various things together, understanding that some of that, maybe much of that, will come from the technical language of the sugya, and other will come from values that are implicit in the system, but might not be local values as much as they are global values. And finally, that learning and thinking about halacha must begin from the classical sources. We need to be aware of their complexity and nuance, but that halacha, if it's not going to just talk to the world that existed at the time of the Gemara, we're going to have to figure out how to translate it into our language. I always talk about this of, is the sugya still there when the Gemara is closed? If you're only using Gemara words, then I don't find Kinle B'Derabi Minei anywhere in the street. And if we're only going to use those terms, then the second we've closed the Gemaras and walked down to the Beit Midrash, the sugya is not with us. If we figure out a way to convert those terms into terms that we do deal with, I think then it's b'lech lecha b'derech b'shoch lecha v'kumecha. Now, my final word of caution, and I want to return to the sugya we dealt with before. Recall that when we were trying to figure out whether the kablan is within the scope of the isur of Baal Talin, the Gemara said that it turns on this question of whether uman kone b'shvach kli or not, whether the what we'll call the jobber, right, the guy hired for a job, acquires rights to the thing as he's building it. Based on that, the Rishonim say there's basically three categories. So if I hire someone to carry a letter for $100, certainly he's not adding any value to the letter. So there, l'kulei alma, according to everybody, he's within the scope of the Isur. Right? If I go to Bob's chair manufacturing and say, Bob, here's some wood, build a chair for me, and Bob does it, that's where there's a machloket in the poskim. Because that, the question is, how do we understand it? Is Bob selling me back a chair, or am I hiring Bob to build me a chair? Finally, if I go to Jim's construction, and I say, build me a chair, but Jim has the wood himself, and fashions me a chair, then, kuli alma, I've just bought the chair from him, he's not within the Isur. That's, if you look in Shulchan Aruch, the way it basically boils down. There's a temptation here from the values approach to say, ah, I understand what's going on here. It's true that whether uman kone b'shvach kli or not doesn't seem to have anything to do with the underlying morals or ethics of the Isur. But notice what happened. We have a continuum of three workers. The first guy is probably the most unskilled. Right? He's hired just for his muscle, right, to carry the letter or do whatever. He's the lowest class of worker. That's why he's vadai within the Isur. The middle guy is skilled labor, right, and a little bit higher, and that's why it's machlokas. And the last guy, not only is he of skilled labor, but he clearly has access to capital, because I don't need to give him the wood, he can get the wood himself. So he's the highest form, and therefore doesn't need the Isur. This is tempting, except the words ani v'ashir, which is basically what we're talking about here, are not outside of the Talmud's conceptual imagination. They know how to say that. In fact, in this very sugya, they tell us, bein v'ani, bein v'ashir. So if I were to try to reconstruct the categories to, quote, reflect this value, I would need to explain why is it that the Gemara talked about uman kone b'shvach kli, and I keep on trying to reform that into ani v'ashir, words that are perfectly within the conceptual imagery of the Gemara itself. Now, final question is that at some level we're talking about what lawyers call levels of generality. Right? There's a temptation of this values approach to constantly liberate the halachot from their fact-centric context to expressing other ideas. As I said, ours is not the first generation to ask this question. Arguably, no sooner did the first rabbis get on the scene, someone asked this question. He's known as Saul, but a lot of people call him Paul. And I think it's not incredible, in fact, a wholly credible reading of a lot of what's going on in Paul and in the New Testament itself, is that they're saying, hey, why are you guys obsessing over all these details? The Sabbath is not for man, but man is for the Sabbath. Did I get that wrong? Maybe. To show you that it's not Torah, right? right, when, but if you look at Masechet Mikvaot, to take another example, it asks the following questions. You're supposed to dip in a pool of water. What do you mean by dip? What do you mean by in? What do you mean by pool? And what do you mean by water? That is Masechet Mikvaot. You'll hear more about Mikvah soon. There is, now there are agadotas elsewhere, but that's the core. And then questions of spiritual transformation and all that kind of nice fluffy stuff is exactly what I said, nice fluffy stuff. Paul thinks the opposite. There are some debates about what it means to dip in a pool of water, but the locus is, of course, or not of course, the locus is on the other sorts of questions. Such that anyone claiming to be an heir to Chazal must understand that these questions are not new, and that no fair read of the tradition can simply constantly try to liberate all these fact-specific details from their context. That it seems to be that at every point that this question was raised, in some sense or another, there was a pushback against it and a return to thinking about it through these legal categories. And that, I think, is our word of caution and our word of challenge. We tread here on very holy ground, and we ought to tread extremely delicately.
So we will hold the many questions and thoughts that this talk has raised, hopefully to sprinkle through the presentations throughout the day. We will have a break now. We will begin with the next session sharp at 10:35, okay, so 12 minutes from now. There are two sessions, one up here, which will be led by me, on Mikvaot and the integration of values-based halakha and mechkar, critical academic study. Downstairs by Rabbi Michael Rosenberg, Dan Bitulim and the ways in which a values-based halakha can avoid excessive stringencies or leniencies that can come about by formalism. Again, if you did not register before today...